This is The Guardian.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
A surreally upbeat and optimistic Conservative conference ended on Wednesday with all four leadership candidates giving their big pitch.
The country just voted for change, and all we've got is more managed decline.
We need to choose someone to lead us who has already done their apprenticeship.
We all know that this country cannot afford Labour. You can't afford Labour, I can't afford Labour.
An opportunity to make Angie uncomfortable, to make Rachel wriggle, and make Starmer sweat.
There was still no real sense of a party honestly looking at its predicament. Instead, many of the most popular lines were all about staying defiant and proudly true to Tory values. Two things are still very unclear. Who's going to win this contest and how the Tories will even start to recover? I'm John Harris and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today at the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham is Kieran Stacey, The Guardian's political correspondent. Hello, Kieran.
Hey, John.
I should make it clear, we're in this very strange sort of airlock, a very small room in this quite bizarre convention centre. And mere yards away, there are people taking down all the paraphernalia of a conference very loudly. That's what the banging is.
Yeah, either that or they're executing the failed leadership candidates behind that door.
Oh, well, that brings us neatly on to our next subject. We've just heard the four candidates for leader, Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch, in that order. They were all on the main stage making their case. We'll talk about that in detail a bit later. In general, what's your sort of key thought about this conference, do you think?
I mean, there is a huge amount of cope going on at this conference. There's a lot of people telling themselves that Labour is in a much worse position than they are.
Yeah,
I've had people tell me that Keir Starmer won't last until the next election. Yeah. They're convinced Sue Gray will be out by kind of December. They think the whole government is falling apart. I think that probably having gone through the election they've just gone through, they need to tell themselves a bit of that for their own mental well-being. And there's been a real sense of a party kind of coming to terms, maybe not quite coming to terms,
with its own
situation. And you know, it's really fascinating to watch that happen in real time.
I agree with you. It's more sort of rawly political, isn't it, than the conference we were both at, the Labour Party's conference in Liverpool last week. And one of the great clichés everybody says in the press bunker is it's surprisingly upbeat and optimistic, which relates to what you've just said. One of the reasons I think is there's a great relief in not being in power anymore. And you know, we both now have sort of torrid and divided and ugly it got, certainly from sort of Boris Johnson onwards, really. I mean, no, prior to that, right? Brexit and Theresa May and so on.
Yeah.
And the idea that all that can be shrugged off and this is a new phase of Tory history and you don't actually have to worry about the realities of power gives them a spring in their step. That's obvious, isn't it? And then the other thing is, it's too soon. It probably would be too soon in the case of any political party for an honest post-mortem. The scale of the defeat hasn't quite sunk in yet.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And what you're saying about kind of almost enjoying reveling in opposition, I mean, that was so clear in Kemi Badenoch's speech. I know we'll come on to talk about the speeches.
She said opposition's fun.
She said it's going to be fun. And as she's saying that, there's a veteran Tory MP stood behind me who goes, that is completely the wrong thing to say. And he said it shouldn't be fun.
Kemi Badenoch, the completely wrong thing to say? Really? Right, well, let's hear a bit more of that conference mood. I got here on Tuesday and I instantly got very happily immersed in what's been going on.
I had lots and lots of doors slammed in my face. And one guy did say to me, you have ruined this country, which I think overstates my personal influence.
I've been coming to Conservative conferences for nearly 20 years now, I think. And particularly when they were in government for all that time. There was such a feeling of power and pomp and money, and obviously it's not like that at all this year. There's almost this very strange sense that the Tories are relieved to be out of government. So they've come here to sort of chew the fat and talk about where they're going. and think about who the next leader is going to be. We've come to a fringe event run by More in Common on what the Tories' path to power, that's their words, might be. And one of the people speaking is Michael Gove.
Congratulations, Michael. Welcome
Hi.
Back. Welcome back to journalism.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Can I ask you a quick question for the Guardian's politics podcast?
Yes.
What's it like now to be on the outside? Not only not in government, but not in Parliament.
It feels disorientating, but fascinating, liberating, but also I'm conscious that I'm now in a position of being a critic once again. I've got to think of myself as a journalist first, and I've got to be a critic first. So that means being critical of some of the things that I was involved with, as well as being critical of the current government. We have some time in order to ensure that over the course of the next 4 years we develop the full suite of policies and the honest conversation about what we need to do next. I think a reflection is that in the immediate aftermath of defeat, almost all political parties need to reassure themselves on certain areas that they are right. And again, part of politics overall is not imposing shock therapy on a patient that is still in recovery, but coaxing it towards the right answer.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Can I leave
you? Keep in touch.
Even if people aren't talking that much about what went wrong, they are really focused on one big thing, one obvious thing, which is who the next Tory leader might be. We all know the field of candidates now: James Cleverly, Tom Tugendhat, Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick. Some people have called this conference a beauty pageant. And really, that's at the heart of this kind of contradiction in the atmosphere. It's quieter. We were in the big conference hotel, the Hyatt, last night, and I remember that place when the Tories were in power. It was mobbed, it went on all night, everyone buying each other drinks. It was the absolute opposite of that last night. But at the same time, the party members who are here are sort of engaged and excited because pretty soon their ballot papers are going to arrive and they're going to make this big decision.
I'm really sorry to interrupt. We work for The Guardian for our sins. Please don't hold it against us. Are you party members?
Yes, yes.
Can I just ask you a quick question for our politics podcast? Yes, sure. A, how are you feeling being here at the conference?
Upbeat. Yeah, upbeat.
Which is quite strange given the fact you've just come out of a pretty thumping defeat. Why do you think people are upbeat?
Because I think we've got the opportunity to change and look at the error of our ways previously. So we've got a new blueprint to put down, and with a new leader, hopefully that will come through.
And who do you like the look of the four candidates?
Well, for me, it's Robert Jenrick at the moment.
Tell me why.
Because I think he's a clear speaker, decisive, and has got strength.
Anybody else?
I was quite keen on Kemi. But I think she just can't put the brakes on, let's put it that way.
And she opens her mouth, she doesn't quite know what's going to come out.
Yeah, and you can't reverse, really, sometimes when you've said something. So I'm leaning towards Jen, but I haven't made up my mind. I'm not James Cleverly, but I haven't made up my mind.
Why not James Cleverly?
Because I don't think he's got the heft. I just don't think he's a nice guy. I don't think he's got quite the intellectual substance, perhaps, that the other... Less than the other three.
Okay. If I was to say to you that perhaps what the Conservative Party might need is a sort of modern David Cameron to come around the corner and talk about modernising the party and returning to liberal conservatism and being comfortable with the country Britain is, you're shaking your head, you don't like that.
No, I voted for David Cameron. I thought he was a breath of fresh air when he first came forward. But now I put James Cleverly in that mould, and it's too chummy and too nice, and we need somebody who's more stronger and more decisive.
In a very funny way, I sort of I quite admire their defiance. You know, everybody out there is saying this party's really badly had it and needs a fundamental rethink of everything. And all the people we meet, or most of them, feel that the message is, or was, basically right. The problem is how it was delivered. And you don't want any of that sort of modernising liberal kind of stuff, because that's just kind of too nice for its own good and too cuddly. And you want sort of forthright, strong leadership. They're kind of unrepentant, aren't they? They really like the fact they're here. Every fringe meeting has a great big queue outside it, and everyone's sort of animatedly having a chat about things in the queue. It's weird, isn't it? The Labour Party's just won last week, and you know, the word that sticks in my head the most that someone uttered in my ear about that conference was it was funereal. And this one's more like a 21st. We're outside Hall 4. This is the most maze-like of all conference venues. It's sort of disorientating from the moment you get here. But I'm told I'm outside Hall 4. That'll give you a very vivid picture of where I am. And I'm, we're about to meet Ian Duncan Smith, former Work and Pension Secretary, former leader of the Conservative Party. Ian Duncan Smith, the atmosphere here, considering the Conservative Party has just been through an awful, some would say historic, defeat, yeah, feels almost surreally upbeat, doesn't it?
Well, it is in a way. It's because I think the defeat was so great that people aren't now reaching for sort of easy options. They're now talking about where are we going, what are we going to do, and that's a more prolonged debate. Second thing is, completely out of the blue, the Labour Party had a car crash conference last week with rows about spending and everything else, and that always makes lifts people a bit if you're on the other side, to see the other side, having just got elected, has seen their poll rating go down and them mired in arguments that they used to make about everybody else on sleeves.
You and I both know the Conservative Party has a very, very low vote share among most people under 35, 40, let alone under 25. Yep. The Conservative Party lost places which historically you'd have thought of as its absolute home turf. Guildford, Woking, Surrey Heath, lots of places in the southeast, right? Now, rationally, any party that goes through that really ought to be asking itself fundamental questions, instead of which I get here and the leading leadership candidates are all banging on about the ECHR.
This result is peculiar. I was here in 97. In 97, we lost big time, but we lost big time to the Labour Party. In other words, 44% share of the vote, and many Conservatives voted for Blair. So our problem as a party was, although big, it was still Labour. It's different this time. We have a Labour Party that had 33% of the vote and got into power with people losing many of their majorities and some losing their seats. The biggest problem is what happened to the Tory vote. And it didn't really go to Labour. It went either to Reform, it in some cases went to any other party that it could do, or it stayed at home. So what we've got to figure out is, what does it take for the Conservative Party to re-establish itself on its values and its sense of what they need to do,
yes,
enough to be able to license people to think about returning? And that, by the way, would include younger people. And you've got to be showing them that you stand for things that the other parties are incapable of delivering.
Last question. Yeah. Do you yourself have a sense of your preference yet?
No.
Really?
None. I
you
can't.
Must have some vague sense of them.
No. Every time I think about, oh, maybe someone, I go, oh, no, not really.
Anyone you're ruling out?
No, not at the moment. My problem is I'm looking for something which I don't think others are at the moment, but I think it's the right thing to look for, and it's character.
Right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I think quietly Ian Duncan Smith probably is not necessarily thrilled with aspects of this race so far, because there isn't much calm, thoughtful consideration of the party's predicament. A lot of people are just running around, sounding off. You know, I don't think he was telling me a white lie when he said he hadn't really made his mind up. So he's one of the remaining Tory MPs. He gets a say in who the final two are, and then it goes to the membership. And we really need to go and find some of them. Outside another PAC fringe meeting, we meet Honor, a Conservative activist who's at Exeter University, whose Toryism is a little bit different from a lot of people here.
I'd openly say I'm very liberal in my Conservatism, very central.
Does it worry you, therefore, that Robert Jenrick might be the leader? Because whatever he is, he's not liberal.
Yeah. I don't think necessarily my own personal views and values are represented by really any of them too well. I think Tom Tugendhat most closely, I think he's much more centrist in his approach, and I think his job is more so about uniting the party, which I like. But at the same time, there's a lot of youth support for Kemi. There's a lot of youth support for Jenrick, which was really surprising, going around speaking to people, saying they're Team Badenoch.
Conservative leaders or senior figures from history or recent history, who did you like or have you liked?
Here we are. This is a tough question for me. I think I'd more on the side of Blairite, Labour left policies more appeal to me personally.
But you're a Tory, you're a member of the party.
I am a member of the party, wow. Yes.
Could you ever see yourself defecting to the Labour Party?
Absolutely, yes. I think that, you know, they're spending too much time focusing on all the votes they lost to Reform. And I just think you lost more seats to the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party than you did to Reform.
Okay.
Why is this, you know, right wing, oh, we're all on the far right of the party, why is that view the loudest? It's going to be that social push, I think, that will kick me out of the Conservative Party, in all honesty.
No, really, you're a member of the Conservative Party?
I am.
See, not everyone here fits the kind of caricatures you might think. They were young people who were backing Tom Tugendhat with some reservations. And actually they illustrated why the Tory party's got a huge historic problem. If you even begin to look into the future and where young people are with this party, it ain't going to be answered by Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch type politics. In the conference foyer, we meet Danny Kruger, the MP for East Wiltshire and very senior backer of the supposed frontrunner, Robert Jenrick. Why did the Conservative Party lose the last election, and why did it lose it so badly?
We lost the election because we failed to deliver on the promises that we'd made to the public to secure the borders, fix the economy, restore the NHS. And we've got lots of good reasons why we couldn't do those things, but fundamentally we failed, and the public rejected us because of that.
Why is Robert Jenrick the solution to that?
He is himself a young politician, the youngest in the race. He's a millennial. He joined the Conservative Party in the wake of our last defeat when Tony Blair came in. And he, I think, speaks for possibly the most important thing that we can do for the younger generation, which is to get house building, to help people to get on the housing ladder and support their families. He also, I think, can help reach those voters who feel that we failed on migration, to fail to secure our borders, haven't stood up for our country.
You say that, but I hear more of the sort of reform-esque side of him than I do the side that might appeal to younger people. And in fact, when one thinks about the very, very small proportion of younger people, 18 to 24s, even older than that, actually under 40s, who vote Conservative now, and then you see senior Conservatives like Robert Jenrick banging on about the ECHR and grammar schools and all of that, do you not think that just furthers those people's sense that this kind of politics has nothing to say to them at all? I don't meet anyone at all, actually, let alone anyone under 40, who ever talks about the ECHR.
If we're serious about securing our borders and ensuring that we can deport terrorists and manage the security of this country, we need to leave the ECHR. That's our argument, and we need to make that in a way that is convincing to people, because I agree with you.
We need your voice in this podcast.
We can
sorry
do
to
whatever
catch you
like. Where do you want to go?
Just sort of here. It's Wednesday morning. Everyone here is about to go into the main hall to hear these four speeches from the leadership candidates. And I've just bumped into Jesse Norman, the Conservative MP for, I always forget the name of your constituency,
Hereford and South Herefordshire, John.
Okay. I was quite surprised, given that you are known for being a sort of one nation, pre-Thatcher kind of Conservative, forgive me, that you're supporting Kemi Badenoch.
Yes, I mean, I was an early supporter of Kemi's. I came out for her in July, and, you know, I know her, I highly rate her. I think she's a very thoughtful person. She's willing to listen to people around her. I think she would say that, you know, she's still learning, as I think all the candidates are still learning. I don't think any of them is the finished article quite yet. You wouldn't expect them to be with 5 years for election. But I think she's got incredible energy and punch and cut through. And I think, you know, if you look at it from a Starmer or a Farage perspective, you know, she's the only candidate they're going to be really afraid of.
Oh, you think she answers both questions, potentially?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any chance the Conservative Party is going to pitch off towards Farage and Reform, but I think it's going to go after their voters.
Right.
And I also think Kemi has the capacity to, you know, appeal to a much wider spectrum of the population.
What about the question of uniting the party? She's quite a divisive politician, and she says very pointed, robust things, as we've seen over the last few days, that get her in trouble.
Well, I mean, I think you, my sister John, and even less thoughtful members of the media do have a slight interest in kind of magnifying these things. Obviously, we're in a hothouse environment of a conference, so you'd expect that.
She's not a conciliator, is she, by temperament? She doesn't look like one.
Well, I think she's someone who knows that if you're going to be successful in politics, you have to take the fight to the enemy, and the point of an opposition is to be a vigorous voice for opposing government. Not on everything, but on everything where it's wrong. And in this government, we're seeing a lot of early evidence that there's plenty of errands where it's wrong. So I think that's pretty good, actually. I do also think that there's a big difference between what the media likes to call a gaffe, which is often just plain speaking,
yeah,
and something that is genuinely a meditated sort of error. of some kind. And of course, you know, one person's error is the next person's ideological belief. You know, having some pretty tough words about the fact that the civil service isn't all, you know, perfect, and I'm a big supporter of the civil service, that's a reasonable thing.
Do you worry that there is a real danger of the Conservative Party doubling down on a lot of things which lost it the last election and also are responsible for the fact that so few young people proportionately vote Conservative, that there's no Conservative MPs in cities and so on? There is a danger, is there not, that the party will sort of lurch off to Farage kind of politics and further alienate people that it needs if it's ever going to win again?
I mean, I don't think there's any chance that the Conservative Party is going to, you know, move off towards Farage-type politics.
Really? What's Robert Jenrick then?
Well, I think you're hearing a lot of fighting talk to the membership, but if you ask me where I think the party's going to be in terms of opposition over the next 5 years, I don't think there's any chance of that.
But the Conservative Party's not going to win again by banging on about the ECHR ad infinitum, is it?
No, I agree with you. And you are talking to the only Conservative who wrote a book called The Conservative Case for the Human Rights Act, so I would say that.
There's always hope.
Thank you, John. Very nice to
talk
to you.
Thank you very much indeed. Cheers. Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be talking to Keir Stacey about how the candidates did in their big conference speeches.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Outside us, all the bits and bobs of Tory conference are being packed away, ready for next year. The four leadership candidates have closed this year's conference with 20-minute speeches. It says 20 minutes. They felt longer to me.
They were longer.
On the main stage. Let's go through some of what we heard. The first candidate up was Tom Tugendhat, the alleged One Nation candidate, who delivered this very sort of rambly, hesitant, uncertain speech. I think probably because there were things that in his gut he would have liked to say and he just knew he couldn't.
In this leadership election, you have a choice. And it's a choice about change. My opponents claim that they've got more management experience around the cabinet table. Sure, that's true. But I'm not here to manage. I'm here to lead.
So it was full of platitudes and it didn't have any shape. And I thought, fell flat. I thought he sort of ruled himself out with that speech completely. I mean, it's not like he's going to win anyway. Everybody knows that, but that was really confirmed, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We were talking last night in the bars around the conference centre that this felt like a four-way contest all of a sudden. Tom Tugendhat had done a very good Q&A on stage a couple of days ago.
And it's very visible around here. People running around with Tom Tugendhat baseball
caps. Yeah, it's very well
organised.
Yeah. And they're there to cheer him everywhere he goes. And he's done some quite nice things. He got his soapbox out and stood on that and spoke. But when it came to the big moment, it's actually just not his forte. And I've seen him give speeches before, and he does have this slightly hesitant, very quiet style. And one of the other campaign officials was saying it was like their speech of a Cambridge Don giving a lecture on Keats. And
weirdly, while he's banging on about having been a soldier and fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, he's the least belligerent former soldier you could possibly imagine.
And it's, you know, it's quite disarming. And I spoke to him afterwards. He came out of the hall and he came to speak to a few of us, and his hands were shaky and his voice was trembling. Clearly, he was extremely nervous about that speech.
Yeah. And not really banging the One Nation drum, as I said. There was a sort of contorted aspect to it. He just can't do it.
No, you just can't. I mean, I don't blame them. You know, this is not the audience to do it for. And as Keir Starmer showed us, you know, when you're trying to win a leadership contest, you have to tack one way. And then if you have to tack the other way afterwards, well, that's the game. The thing is, for Tom Tugendhat, I think there's something quite vulnerable about him. And you see through that veneer of, you know, I'm a right winger, really, very quickly. And it just doesn't come across as authentic.
No, he's not even convincing himself.
No.
James Cleverly was next on. Let's hear a bit of what he had to say.
So let's be more like Reagan. Let's be enthusiastic, relatable, positive, optimistic. Let's be more normal.
Now, I'll cut to the chase. I thought this was hands down the best speech.
Yeah.
Just as a sort of example of oratory and how to do it. It was punchy. He delivered it in a very sort of measured, powerful way. And he was as close as any of them got, really, to being honest with the party about his predicament. I also liked it because his shtick, and I think it's authentic, actually, is that he's a sort of every bloke.
Yeah.
And he's a bit David Brent. And he leans into it.
Yeah.
His video, which is very amateurishly put together, began with him leaning at the camera and he goes, "Let's do this." Very David Brent. His other line, which is extremely David Brent, was, "There's no time to lose and I don't lose." I mean, straight out of the office, right? It's but fantastic. I quite like the fact he just leant into that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, yes, he did have some lines where he was telling the Tory membership some hard truths. Actually, so did Tom Tugendhat. Tom Tugendhat had a really good line where he said, "Our immigration problem is not about foreign courts, it's about visas. And then we have made these choices to issue these visas to keep the health service going." It was a line that Keir Starmer could have delivered. Right. It was a really interesting moment, but partially because of his delivery, it just didn't quite come across. Cleverly, yes, he delivers hard truths, but he's also the guy who once called the Rwanda scheme batshit, yeah, and now says he'll bring it back in as soon as if he ever becomes prime minister. So I think there is plenty of, you know, playing to the crowd. But the thing that he has going for him and the thing that comes across in that hall is he's just happy in his own skin. And, you know, that's truer of him than I think it is of almost any other candidate. And he projects it very, very well. He also came out to speak to us afterwards. He had his wife, Susie, next to him, and he just looked like he was so delighted. He was absolutely in his prime. That's where he wants to be.
It's an overlooked sort of criterion, I think, for how you judge whether a politician is any good and going places is whether they look like they're enjoying it.
Yeah, that's true. And I think he and Badenoch both have that sense of, like, you know, I like doing this and I'm okay with it and I'm okay with myself. Now, very few people on the Labour front bench have that, actually. And I think he'd be quite a formidable opponent for Keir Starmer and for a lot of the other Labour front benches, for exactly
but
that
But he is
reason.
By no means the favourite. He remains a bit of an outsider in this contest.
I think less so after this conference.
Do you think this might change things?
I think it will change things. First of all, I'm now getting a very strong sense from Tory MPs that I think he is just as likely to go through to the final two as Kemi Badenoch is. There's a feeling that Kemi Badenoch may have maxed out her support, certainly with some of her gaffes during this conference. There's people saying, oh, maybe she's not the right person for us. I was also watching, I thought this was really interesting, on the front row today, while each of these people were giving their speeches, there were some quite prominent party bigwigs who haven't actually declared yet. So people like Jeremy Hunt, next to him was Andrew Mitchell. Now, these are One Nation people, but it was interesting. I just did think that actually a lot of the people who haven't declared are quite centrist and played prominent roles in the last government. And each of them looked like they really enjoyed James Cleverly's speech.
Third speech might have been the most anticipated in the sense that there's been a lot of talk about Robert Jenrick being the front runner. There were also whispers swirling around the press bunker that overnight he'd lost his voice.
Yeah.
On he came in this sort of blizzard of learned hand gestures. It was like someone had given him this website called How to Give a Speech Like a Successful Politician. And it said, hand gesture number one, hand gesture number two. He was doing the parallel hands and the one fist bounces into the other hand and the raised hand and all that, right? Sort of striding around the stage and not really comfortable in this costume that he decided to wear, right?
Yeah, someone's described him as the AI candidate. And there is something about that of him, isn't there? This, you know, he's got the shiny face and the new haircut.
Buzz cut. Hard man buzz cut.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite the look.
Yeah.
I mean, someone described it as a fascist haircut, but I don't know if I'd go that far. But
I don't think he would, just to make
I'm
that
sure
clear.
He wouldn't say that, but it's quite the hard man haircut, like you say. But also, there was all this hype around him speaking with no notes, and he did speak with no notes, and that is an impressive trick to pull off, but I would say it's a little dated. And as well as speaking with no notes, you've got to be really impressive. You can't just do the no notes thing. You have to give a great speech as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it just fell slightly short of that.
Yeah, it's quite a sort of an unachievement, so to speak, to speak without notes and yet look inauthentic and very forced and laboured. It's the very thing that speaking without notes is meant to stop you doing.
Yeah,
and he didn't succeed in that at all, did he? Robert Jenrick kept talking about a new Conservative Party. But what really struck me was that his vision of this new Conservative Party is much like the one we've got that lost the election. He went on and on about the European Convention on Human Rights. Migration is his pet subject. He talks about that a lot. Generally, he's got this very sort of paranoid style of politics. You know, English identity is under siege and all that. Leaning into the more reformy bits of the Conservative Party. So it's not really a new Conservative Party at all.
And the truth is this. If we are going
to change this party, to restore the trust and the confidence of the people, if we're going to tackle together the immense challenges our country faces, we are going to have to build something new, a new Conservative Party. That is what I call for today. A new Conservative Party, nothing less.
Well, it was interesting that you described him as inauthentic, because I think the problem he has, and even his supporters say this, he's not that guy. He was known as a centrist. He was a very strong ally of Rishi Sunak's. The kind of positive spin on this that one of his supporters gave me was that he's a centrist who's hardline on immigration, and that's where the public is. The problem is the way he talks about it is not quite the same way as the public talks about it. And as you say, he comes across as trying to act and sound much tougher than he really is.
Exactly right. I thought he was like the nerdy kid at school who starts hanging around with the bullies. And when they give him a cigarette, he doesn't know how to hold it properly. He was a bit like that. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yeah. And it reminded me of when George Osborne had his makeover as well, and started trying to act the tough man.
The power stance, the power and the Caesar cut and all that.
Yeah.
I felt in the hall that the generic speech felt flat. He was carrying that supposed front-runner mantle, and that puts you in a fragile place.
It's a difficult thing to do, isn't it?
And it definitely didn't work, did it?
And the other thing is, as I was kind of saying before, the fact that his spinners had gone around briefing, oh, he's going to do it without notes, it just kind of elevated expectations that this was going to be the absolute barnstorming speech of a conference. So, and I suspect this whole thing about him losing his voice overnight was a sudden desperate attempt to play down expectations, because they suddenly realised, oh no, everybody's expecting him to blow the roof off, and we better put something out there to make it sound like he might not.
In politics, absurd sometimes. Someone actually got up at about 5 o'clock this morning and thought, I know, let's put it around the conference that Robert's lost his voice.
Yeah, or drunkenly did so while they were still up at 5 a.m, I suspect.
That explanation. Right, the last speaker on was Kemi Badenoch. It's worth hearing a bit of what she had to say.
For us, it led to a reckoning, a historic defeat worse than 1997, a defeat that could extinguish the Conservative Party. We have to get this right. We have to renew. And then we can regain the trust of the British people.
Kemi Badenoch had the obvious advantage, they drew straws, didn't they, of being the last person on. Her speech went down very well in the hall. Again, I thought her speech was built on a central contradiction. She said towards the end very pointedly that she wanted a country at ease with itself.
Mm.
But she wants the culture wars not just to carry on, but to get even worse, right? So that won't be a country at ease with itself at all. And interestingly, as well, as we all know, in the build-up to this, she'd sort of shot her mouth off. That's been her experience of conference.
Yeah.
How do you think that kind of build-up played into the speech and how it was received?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say is she's had an absolutely terrible conference. If anybody's blown themselves up, if any of these candidates have done their candidacy's damage, it's her. And that whole row we had, first of all, about maternity pay, and then she made it worse by claiming that she hadn't said it, and then talking about minimum wage. And it was just like every time she opened her mouth, there'd be a negative news story to come out. Going after civil servants, saying 5 to 10% of civil servants are go to prison bad. And then again claiming that she'd been misquoted, even though we've all seen the quotes. So it's just thing after thing. But what was really interesting, I think she is a good speechmaker, actually. I thought it was quite... It was presented quite well. She actually did get a bit of a balance between light and shade. She did some sunny optimism as well. But it was really telling to me that all three of the other candidates came out to speak to us afterwards. She completely refused to do so.
Really?
She was surrounded by a coterie of officials who stopped any camera, any reporter getting close to her, and just ushered her straight out. So they know she can deliver a speech. She can woo the party faithful like that. But as soon as she starts doing Q&As, one-on-ones, she's liable to say something she shouldn't.
What if you're the leader of the opposition, let alone the prime minister? That's kind of part of the job. Again, in a different way, quite a paranoid style of politics. There was that phrase in the Cold War, Reds under the bed, the idea that people were looking for sort of subversion and communism everywhere. And her speech was like that when she said the left never left. The idea we've had 14 years of Tory government, but actually the left was secretly in power.
And this is the theme of this conference, and this is why it's going to take them a few years, maybe electoral cycles, to get over the defeat, because the theme of this conference, speaking to almost everybody here, is the reason they lost the election is because they weren't authentically Tory enough. If they just leant right, I mean, first of all, you'd win back the reform voters, but somehow you'd also appeal to the electorate at large. How many people have we heard over the last few days talk about the state of the NHS or, public services more broadly, roads or rail? yes, the public cares about immigration, but for the last 4 days, you'd have thought that's the only thing that any voter cares about.
Yeah, the only exception is house building.
Bit of house building, yeah.
And kind of tributes to the golden age of people buying their council houses and so on. But completely, yeah, they're still stuck in much the same groove that they were before. And the thought time and again, which has popped into my head, is really about what we both know, that anyone under 40, the chances of them being a Tory voter are very slim. Once you get under 25, there's vanishingly small numbers of people voting Conservative at the last election. We've been having this conversation with people we met around the place, and I don't think I've heard anything that either mentions that, let alone offers any hope of getting to grips with it as far as the Tories are concerned. And in fact, this sort of defiant, we were right, the messaging was just wrong, immigration, ECHR, will carry on. That's exactly what ensures that younger people in particular don't vote Conservative.
Yeah.
Or that people in cities that don't vote Conservative. Yeah. You know?
That's obviously true. The only thing I'd say is, kind of the more thoughtful Tories around this conference, the way they put it is, look, we have to go through this moment because you've essentially got four people trying to win over the membership.
Yeah, sure.
Once we get over this, once they've got a leader in place, they can then start talking to the rest of the country. And supporters of Robert Jenrick in particular say this. They say, look, you know, he's having to put on these clothes.
Well, he'll become a centrist again.
He'll become a centrist again.
Oh, but he's so dug in, surely.
Well, I think it's... Either he's too dug in or, you know, it's just so obviously a ploy. It's so obviously inauthentic that I think the public just won't wear it.
And then to go back to something you said earlier, if you were a Tory, taking them and an enlightened, thoughtful Tory of the kind you just mentioned, wanting the party to honestly look at its predicament and begin to renew and rebuild, right? On the most optimistic projection, when do you think at least a flavour of that is going to start to appear? Because it wasn't here, let's be honest.
No, it wasn't here. I think probably this time next year, I think you'll see, you know, once you've got a new leader in place, once they've got their team in place, once they've kind of, they'll have a little while of just punching Labour, which obviously is what they should do, and they'll have fun doing that. And then I think leaders' speech next year, you're going to have to see some reckoning of, all right, that's what we went through and this is where we're going to get to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for these people, the journey's only just started. Well, yeah. I'll probably be back here next year and so will you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
In the meantime, as the song goes, back to reality. Thanks for joining us, Kieran.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK. Kieran and Pippa will be back on Monday with Politics Weekly Westminster. And if you've missed what's been happening in the US election, our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, has all the fallout from the first vice presidential debate between Tim Walz and JD Vance from Tuesday night. Listen to that wherever you get your podcast. This episode was valiantly produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier. And the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
In Deutschland streamen jeden Tag Millionen von Menschen Musik, Podcasts und Online-Radio. Digital Audio ist mehr als nur ein Hintergrundgeräusch. Es ist ein wichtiger Bestandteil des täglichen Lebens. Und mit seinen präzisen Targeting-Möglichkeiten ist es eines der am schnellsten wachsenden Medien überhaupt. Erfahren Sie auf katzdigital.com, wie Digital Audio Ergebnisse liefert. Das ist katzdigital.com.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.